Katie's going to she's going to read our passage for us, which is in Mark chapter 8. So that's those little booklets that you've probably got on your seats. But first, she's going to tell us how she became a Christian. So over to you.
I think that your mathematical ability tells you a lot about who you are and the way you think. And for a geographer, that's a very brave statement. There are some amazing people who just understand math. You can present them with a problem, and without any hesitation at all, they can tell you the correct answer and how to get to it. For me, maths has never been easy. It never suddenly becomes clear the way it does for other people. My journey to becoming a Christian has been much like my mathematical abilities. Unlike some accounts you may have heard of people suddenly finding a God they've never known before, there was no sudden break in the clouds for me. More of a slow, methodical turning of cogs until the pieces finally clicked into place. It's almost difficult for me to explain how it happened because it all happened so slowly, I hardly noticed. My close family aren't Christians, but I remember going to church when I was little. As a three-year-old, after being given the part of Mary in the school play, I know that my favourite reenactment in our garden was the Nativity story. So thinking about God and church and religion was never an alien concept to me. It was just one which had no resonance in the real world. When the time came at school for me to go to confirmation classes, I decided that it wasn't right for me. School was hectic, and I had so little time. How could I know if the God of Christianity was the right God if I hadn't looked into every religion and read every religious text? I knew that this was something I needed to look into, and obviously it was something that had to be done before I died. But I was only young, and death seemed so far away. So when the information pack dropped through our letterbox from university, I decided not to tick the box that would mark me out as a Christian. I was starting a new phase in my life. I was finally a student. I could do anything and be anyone, and I wasn't ready to decide on the big things just yet. I joined the hockey club and the drinking society, and although I still claimed duress, boat club. Things were wonderful. I had new friends, and amazingly, I was actually enjoying my degree. But I had an uneasy feeling, the kind you get when you're told that the doors have been secured for takeoff, and you feel like you've forgotten something really important. I had absolutely everything I could want. In fact, everything I'd spent my life working for. But that was just the problem. It all seemed so temporary. If the world ends tomorrow, what's the point? Having never really discussed life and death with anyone before, I was shocked to learn about the beliefs of some of my friends. They weren't at all alarmed that death was just the end and nothing more. I think what shocked me even more were the beliefs of my Christian friends. Far from being scared about death, they seemed to look forward to it. Later on in turn, a second revelation came when these same friends discussed the God they believed in. Rather than being a distant, theoretical concept they only thought about on Sundays, their God was real. They could talk to him through prayer. And even more bizarrely, he would answer those prayers. This concept was so strange to me, so different from the Christianity I'd learned about at school, that I was interested in finding out more. When the main event arrived in February, the Kikyu were putting on a talk about the tsunami in the Indian Ocean. And being vaguely geographical, I decided to go along. I have to confess, I absolutely hated it. Far from tackling any of the questions I had, it just gave me more, and that irritated me. I wanted answers, not to be more confused. After that, I wasn't really interested in going into any of the Christian Union events. But as usual, my friends had other ideas. The next week, I was dragged kicking and screaming to Starbucks, where the main event's Christianity Explored course was being held. Having been coddled with a hot chocolate, a muffin, and a comfortable armchair, I have to confess, I actually started to enjoy myself. To my surprise, it wasn't intimidating at all. And even though I asked really stupid questions, and at times really rude ones, I hadn't the courage to ask before. everyone tried their best to answer the questions I had. My most pressing questions related to Jesus and his resurrection. I'd heard the many claims that he had made, and I wanted to make sure there was real proof to what I was being told. I knew what the cost of being a Christian would mean to me, and it wasn't a decision that I was going to make lightly. When the course finished, one of the college guests from the main event suggested I tried going to church, and my wonderful friends were on hand again to take me to theirs. In my true mathematical style, I tried most of the churches in Cambridge before I found the right one. It was on the second Sunday at this church that the last piece finally clicked into place. I still remember the struggle in my head as if it were happening now. All the grumbling and the excuses and the arguments I'd tried to provide suddenly became clear as the facade that I'd created. And all I was left with was just a peace that I'd never experienced before. At last, I understood. Though I knew the gospel message from the Christianity Explored course, I hadn't realized the significance to my life. Before, Jesus had been a mythical figure in a story who had died on a cross, persecuted by those around him. Now I understood that it was for me that he was sent, and that it was for my sins that he died, so that through him I could find the God I'd been searching so long for and have a relationship with him. So here is my challenge to all of you. Whether you know the answer to life, the universe, and everything, why don't you make time in your busy, hectic Cambridge lives to ask the stupid, rude, and unimportant questions that you have? I'm sure that many of the friends sitting among you tonight will be more than willing to answer your questions, and even, if you're really lucky, take you to the cross-examined course. The passage tonight is from the books in Mark in front of you. It's Mark chapter 10, verses 32 through to 45, which is on pages 31 through to 32. Mark chapter 10, verses 32 through to 45. They were on their way to Jerusalem, with Jesus leading the way, and the disciples were astonished, for those who followed were afraid. Again, he took the 12 aside and told them what was going to happen. "We are going up to Jerusalem," he said, "and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him, spit on him, flog him, and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise." Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. "Teacher," they said, "we want you to do for us whatever we ask." "What do you want me to do for you?" he asked. They replied, "Let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory." "You don't know what you're asking," Jesus said. "Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with?" "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with. But to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared." When the 10 heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as ransom for many."
Thanks very much, Katie. Well, the title for today's talk is, well, we're looking at that question that Jesus asked there. What do you want me to do for you? And Philip Jensen's going to come and speak to us now. So I'm just going to hand straight over to him.
Thanks, Barnaby. "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." I love staying in English homes, especially because of the brilliant toilet literature that this country produces. Clearly, you have developed a market for giving presents to people for whom you cannot think of anything to give. One of the books I've come across is He Said What? Quips, Anecdotes and One-Liners, featuring over 2,000 hilarious quotations from Ovid to the Iraqi Information Minister. It's a terrific read. And preparing this talk on politics and power, I turned up this very important volume. Bismarck said, "The less people know about how sausages and laws are made, the better they'll sleep at night." Will Rogers, the American humorist, explained about making laws. "Every time Congress makes a joke, it's a law. And every time they make a law, it's a joke." Bob Hope said, "I thought of politics, but I'm not that good an actor." We've come tonight to something a little bit more serious, like massively, but I will from time to time recall who said what and what they said. Over these 6 nights, we're examining the cross of Jesus by looking at key moments in the Gospel of Mark that you have before us. And tonight, if you just get to that, pages 31, 32, we'll be dealing mainly with that. But as we examine the cross of Jesus, we'll keep finding out that we are the ones being cross-examined. For though we have all kinds of questions about Jesus, we find that he has all kinds of questions of us. And his questions are more penetrating and difficult to answer than our questions are of him. So I hope you'll keep coming each night to each talk, right the way through to Saturday night, to get the full effect of examining the cross of Jesus. And each night, I'm going to offer two ways forward. I'll mention some others as well, but two in particular. One is the cross-examined course that's going to be held from next week on for the rest of the term that was mentioned by Kate, which is such an excellent course where you can, in smaller groups, ask your questions and ask and ask and ask, though you do need to remember that Jesus will keep asking you as many as you ask him, and his are very difficult to answer. But that's for the good. Do go. It's the pink slip, the cross-examined. The other thing that I'm going to do each night is give you the opportunity to get right with God right here and now in the meeting. Because inside your Mark's Gospel, you should have received also a little prayer. And that's what I'm going to finish with. It's the kind of prayer you need to pray to become a Christian. And that's what I'm going to finish with each night. Partly to show you what it is to be a Christian and how to become one, but really to give you the opportunity to make that decision, to make that commitment to God, even tonight. Now tonight I want to start by asking about the meaning of Jesus' death. So verse 45, the last of the verses we have in our reading, "For even the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." Everybody dies, and most deaths look pretty meaningless. She died because she was old and her body was worn out. He died because the car was travelling too fast and he lost control. And she died because she had cancer. But nobody comes into the world in order to die. Some people choose to die for a reason and a purpose. He died as a martyr for his cause. Or she died to rescue somebody. But people are not born in order to die. They're born in order to live. Yet Jesus' whole purpose in coming into the world can be summarized as to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And that's his idea. It's not my idea. That's why I'm saying, sticking with the text of the passage in front of us, it's not my idea. It's not the idea that the disciples wanted for him either. For when he asked them, as you can see in verse 36, his question, "What do you want me to do for you?" None of them said, "Will you die for me?" That wasn't what they were asking. None of them said, "Will you be my ransom price?" That's not what they were asking. One of the themes of Mark's gospel is that the disciples of Jesus didn't understand Jesus. They didn't understand who he was in the first place or why he came in the second place, and they never really understood what was required of them. They were shocked and horrified that he came to die. They knew nothing of their need to be ransomed. They were only expecting power and glory, the liberation by some militaristic, political, national victory. But what do you expect Jesus to do for you? I mean, if you met Jesus and he asked the question of verse 36 of you, "What do you want me to do for you?" What would be your answer? What would you want the Christ, the Messiah, the King of God's kingdom to do for you if you ever met such a person? The disciples, verse 37, wanted power and glory. "Let us sit one at your right hand and the other at the left hand in your glory." What would you ask for? For how we answer this question in verse 36 tells us nothing about Jesus, but tells us a lot about ourselves. What we think is important, what our concerns are, what our desires are, what our hopes and aspirations, life goals were. If you could meet somebody who was, as Jesus is claimed to be, the King of Glory, and he said, "What would you like me to do for you?" Your answer at that point tells us volumes about you, doesn't it? And it would tell volumes about me if you heard my answer. We've distributed Mark's Gospel all through the colleges, and we're very keen for people to be reading Mark's Gospel, both this week and in the coming weeks. If you haven't got a copy of Mark's Gospel, we're happy for you to be taking this with you. But if you have got a copy already in your rooms, then we'd be happy to leave for you to leave this behind for tomorrow night or the next night. But we want people to read it. It's not a huge tome, especially designed for engineers. We've got little numbers all the way through. It's available for us. We can manage it. It really is not going to take the whole of your life just to get through Mark's Gospel. Mark's Gospel comes in two halves. Most halves do have two. The first eight... I'm a geographer too. The first... But I can't keep in the lines when I colour in. That's why I'm not a geographer anymore. The first eight chapters asks the question, "Who is Jesus?" The second asks and answers the question, "Why did Jesus come?" So tomorrow night I'm going to be looking at the very turning point of the gospel, the end of chapter 8, when Jesus finally is recognised for who he is, and he then reveals his plan as to why he's come. And he spells out what is required. In many ways, it's one of the most important talks in this series, because it reveals the very central claims of Jesus. In a sense, you can see its importance because on the back of our blue shirts, hoodies, jumpers, whatever they are that you call them, on the back of them we have that verse out of the end of chapter 8. "What good is it for a man to gain the whole world, yet forfeit his soul?" It's the key kind of question that Jesus confronts humanity with. But when you understand who Jesus is and why he came, then you start to understand what he wants you to do. For who he is will tell you something of what he wants from you. And why he has come will tell you what he wants from you as well. But it's the real combination of who he is and why he's come that spells out for you powerfully what he wants you to do. By the end of chapter 8, He has made it clear who he is and why he's come. He's the Christ who comes to suffer death in order to bring the kingdom of God. But the disciples didn't understand why he'd come. So they didn't understand what was required of them. So Mark records for us a number of classic illustrations in the following chapters, 8, 9, 10, where Jesus explains why he has come and what it will mean for his disciples. In this part of the Gospel, these chapters, Jesus is teaching his disciples about his impending death in Jerusalem. But they just couldn't get the idea. They couldn't get why he'd come. They couldn't get that he'd come to be rejected and killed. Now remember, you and I, we have the terrific advantage of 20/20 vision that comes, commonly called, from hindsight. We know that he's going to die on the cross. We know it's about him rising again to new life 3 days later. We know the end of the story. That puts us at a distinct advantage over the poor disciples. They didn't know any of that. And even when he told them about rising from the dead, they screamed it out because, well, it didn't make sense. It was totally unacceptable. Anyway, rising on the third day meant something completely different to the Jews. And they didn't think he was going to come back out of the grave. That was unthinkable. So from the end of chapter 8, Jesus was teaching his disciples about his impending death in Jerusalem. Look back to page 27, verse 30. They left that place and passed through Galilee. Jesus didn't want anyone to know where they were because he was teaching his disciples. He said to them, "The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days he'll rise." But they didn't understand what he meant and were afraid to ask him about it. Whoever else should have known of the death of Jesus, his disciples should have known because he was teaching them that. Precisely and repeatedly he taught it to them. You see it again in tonight's reading at the bottom of page 31. You see on page 31, verse 32, they were on their way to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way, and the disciples were astonished, while those who followed were afraid. Again he took the 12 aside and told them what was going to happen to him. "We're going to Jerusalem," he said, "and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests, the teachers of the law. They'll condemn him to death. They'll hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit him and flog him and kill him. But 3 days later he'll rise." But this teaching was sufficiently strange as to reverse all normal expectations. You see, normally you expect the great man to be surrounded by bodyguards, for his life is very important to the movement and he needs to be protected. Normally you expect the great man to be too busy with important matters of state to deal with unimportant people. He's dealing with the power brokers, bringing on side the clans and the tribes and the factions and the parties, building up a power block and developing a financial basis. He's getting his defence force and a public relations army and his strategic policy planning group. And that's the way to create a kingdom. And that's the way for the king to create an empire that will last forever. Normally you expect the king to be avoiding danger and battle until he's marshalled all his forces for a final decisive victory over his enemies. But Jesus says, "If I go to Jerusalem, I'm going to be killed. Now come on, I'm on the way to Jerusalem. Come with me." They're astonished, they're amazed. He's going to be killed. That's not the place to go. We've just got a dozen people here. How are we going to take on Jerusalem? That's a ridiculous idea. He's going to be... It didn't make any sense at all. I've not met Prince Charles, but I guarantee that if he ever does think of becoming the next king of Australia, his mother is the Queen of Australia. We chose to have her, unlike you. We have a referendum and retained her. If Charles is ever thinking of becoming the king of Australia, or other places like England, I presume that he is not for a moment imagining that he's going to be taken down to Westminster Abbey and executed. Coronation by execution is not the normal way to become a king, even in a constitutional monarchy. With the ancient world, of course, the method of becoming a king was by conquest, by getting rid of your enemies and your opponents on every front. But being rejected and defeated and killed was certainly not the way in the ancient world either. But this King Jesus is not normal. He's not heading towards Jerusalem with an army to conquer it. He's heading towards Jerusalem and ignominious death that he keeps predicting. And on the way he talks about the first being last and the last being first and everybody being a servant. And he talks about children being given the kingdom of God, and he takes time out to bless them. And he turns to a rich young ruler who would be an ideal candidate for political power. He turns him away with ridiculously hard demands. We're going to look at that on Thursday night. And he accepts in a blind beggar who can't be of any use to anybody in a kingdom. And it was in the midst of this reversal of normal expectations and ways of doing things, as Jesus travels to his destined death in Jerusalem, that the brothers, James and John, the brothers, question him. Teacher, they say, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. Well, what do you want me to do for you? That's the question that Jesus poses. What a question this was. See, here's a man who can walk on water. Here's a man who's fed a multitude of 5,000 people. Here's a man who heals the sick. Here's a man who raises the dead. Here's a man who drives out evil spirits from people. Here's a man who's tamed the uncontrollable man who lived amongst the tombs. Here's a man who can do whatever he wants. Here's a man who can still a storm just by a word. And he is saying, well, now, what would you want me to do for you? Well, he can do all those things plus more. What would you like Jesus to do for you? What would be your desires for this world and the next when the kingdom of God comes? What would you want? At the end of Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, Harry is finally understanding Dumbledore's explanation. But that means he and his wife will die, won't they? They have enough elixir stored to set their affairs in order, and then, yes, they will die. Dumbledore smiled at the look of amazement on Harry's face. To one as young as you, I'm sure it seems incredible, but not to Nicholas and Perronel. It really is like going to bed after a very, very long day. After all, to the well-organized mind, death is but the next great adventure. You know, the stone was really not such a wonderful thing. As much money and life as you could want, the two things most human beings would choose above all. The trouble is, humans do have a knack of choosing precisely those things which are worst for them. What would you ask for? Health? Justice? Your beauty pageant queen? You want world peace? What is it that you long for? Satisfaction? Happiness? So they make their fateful request in verse 37. Let one of us sit at your right hand and the other in your left in your glory. It was such a good request. It fitted in with everything that was happening. See, they'd left their father's fishing industry. They'd left their father and they'd joined up with this Christ. From the very beginning of his public campaign, they were there. And they were there through all his work and through all his victories. And they were in the inner circle of the 12, indeed the inner circle within the 12. And they believed he would bring in this kingdom that would last forever, that people thousands of years later at the other end of the Roman Empire, like Britain, would be talking about it, and thousands of years like we are. They believed in this Jesus bringing in this kingdom. And so what was to be their portfolio when he came to power? When we come to power, what's going to be our ministry? The Chancellor? Foreign Affairs? Home Office? Where am I going to be in the cabinet? At the right hand, at the left hand, in the inner circle, or will we be in the outer cabinet? Are we to be the ambassador? Where am I going to be in the kingdom? Their request was such an act of faith. They were absolutely committed to him. They were confident that he would bring in such a kingdom, that they would be with him through thick and thin, that they would be there at the last day. And they were dreaming the dreams that everybody dreams on the campaign trail. When you become president, when you become prime minister, when you become king, where am I going to be sitting at the table? It was not their request only. The other disciples are recorded in verse 41 as being indignant at James and John, because the brothers had jumped in first. I mean, the only people they'd be displacing at the table were the other disciples. They too should have an opportunity to sit on the right hand, on the left hand. It's so typical of politicians, isn't it? To be more concerned for their position and seniority than for the good of the country. And not just governmental politicians, it's true of office politicians and company executives who rise over each other's careers and all line their own pockets as they appear to rule for the common good, only doing it for the shareholders and their wealth, only doing it for the customers, but making sure that they rise to the top like all good graduates of Cambridge. Here then we see that all the disciples held the normal ambitions for their own place in the kingdom of God. But the normal, the natural in the Bible, is the sinful. For we saw it last night. Just turn back to Mark chapter 7, page 21. Page 21, up there at the top of the page, verses 20 to 23. He went on, "What comes out of a man is what makes him unclean, for from within, out of men's hearts come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, folly." All these evils come from inside and make a man unclean. As elsewhere in the Bible, God says much the same thing. The acts of a sinful nature are obvious. Sexual immorality, impurity, debauchery, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, discord, jealousy, fits of rage. It's all the same. Selfish ambition, dissension, orgies and the like. I warn you, as I did before, that those who live like this will not inherit the kingdom of God. Don't worry about whether you're in the right hand or the left hand. You won't even be there. If you act normally, if you act like you are out of your own heart, you won't even be in the kingdom of God. You are part of the kingdom of humanity, which is to be condemned. The disciples are exhibiting the natural instinct of corrupt humanity, greed and arrogance and selfish ambition and envy, factions, dissensions. Even the world knows that you cannot trust people with power. Douglas Adams wrote, "Anyone who is capable of getting themselves into a position of power should on no account be allowed to do the job." Tony Benn, one of your politicians, wrote, "But whoever is in power, they never like to share it." Power corrupts, and corrupt people seek power. And we are corrupt. This infighting amongst the disciples had been going on for some time. Turn back to page 28. Back to page 28. And there in verse 33 you read, back to page 28, verse 33, they came to Capernaum where he was in the house, and he asked them, "What are you arguing about on the road?" But they kept quiet, because on the way they'd argued about who was the greatest. Sitting down, Jesus called the 12 and said, if anyone wants to be first, he must be the very last and the servant of all. He took a little child and had him stand among them, and taking him in his arms, he said to them, whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me does not welcome me, but the one who sent me. But they didn't understand. They didn't understand because it's so bizarre to think that the kingdom is to be run by the servant. They didn't understand because they didn't understand why Jesus had come. That is, they didn't understand Jesus' death. For without understanding Jesus' death, the kingdom that God brings doesn't make any sense at all. And those of us tonight who are outside of Christianity and scratch your head and think, what makes these Christians Christians? It doesn't make sense. We know how you feel. Because it doesn't. Until you've understood the cross, it will never make sense to you. Which is why we're so keen to share with you about the cross. Well, they didn't understand what they were asking for or what Jesus' answer was in chapter 10, page 32. Because Jesus' answer, verse 38 there, page 32, verse 38, you don't know what you're asking, Jesus said. Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? You see, they thought they were asking for the seats of honour in a normal kingdom. They would have possibly been given such seats of honours, but this was no normal kingdom. This was no normal king. They thought that they would be in the seats of executive power. And in a normal kingdom, they might have been placed in executive power, but this is no normal kingdom, and this is no normal king we're talking about. The kingdom was coming by crucifixion. The king was crowned by assassination. This is not normal. This is weird. If they wanted to be sitting with him in glory, if they wanted to be the office bearers in this kingdom, then they would have to drink the cup of God's wrath like the king was going to. And they'd have to be baptized with his baptism of fire that he was going to go through in Jerusalem. You don't know what you're asking, Jesus says. Can you drink the cup that I am going to drink? Or be baptized with my baptism? They knew nothing of his death. Nothing of what Jesus was about to experience that would have to be experienced if the kingdom of God was to come into this world. For his death was not like any normal death. His death was to be the sacrifice for the sins of the whole world kind of death. He was going to drink the cup of God's wrath to the very bottom of the dregs. You need to keep coming. Saturday night, Friday night, we'll be talking especially about what that death really was that they couldn't have. So Jesus asked, can you? Verse 38, can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized? They couldn't bear the wrath of God for others. They couldn't be the sacrifice for the sins of the world. They couldn't do the work of sin-bearing. But they, like so many young and foolish men, thought they could do anything. Declared their readiness to go through whatever it took. They had no idea what they were saying when they piped up with the confident, "We can!" But only say it because they didn't know what they were saying. In part, this is why we, or at least I, like the disciples. That's partly why I also have confidence, only a small part, but it's partly why I have confidence in the Gospel's historical trustworthiness. Because although these are the founding apostles of Christianity, the original 12 disciples, the witnesses of Jesus and his resurrection, they are not glamorized in the slightest by the Gospels. The New Testament shows no signs of improving them as mythical heroes like later legends would. They continue to be foolish and stupid. They are the foils of Jesus, never understanding what's happening and only speaking to get it wrong. You're dealing with history here, friends, not fiction. And so sadly, Jesus tells them of their future, that you will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with my baptism. For the followers of Jesus do have to take up the cross and follow him. More of that tomorrow night. For all who desire to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. That just goes with the territory. They cannot die his death for the sins of others, but they will die his death in following him. And they were martyred subsequently. But what about the seats of honour? Well, they're not even for Jesus to give. Verse 40, but to sit at my right hand and my left's not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they've been prepared. The disciples' work, being the apostles of Jesus, does not assure them of any special place in heaven. When we get there, who do you think will stand out as important? St. Peter at the gate? It's nowhere in the Bible. Don't believe it. Who's going to stand out as the big ones that we will see? Are the great apostles? No. The great heroes of church history? No. Whoever will be least will be greatest. Be some unknown little saint that you've never heard of, never read of, and most of us didn't know was in existence. Christian ministry is not a supernatural career move. There's no higher place reserved for these two men. That's the way the world thinks about careers and kingdoms, about promotions and favours, about places of prominence and importance. But the kingdom of Jesus is radically, completely different to anything we've thought of. Nor are we to think that we can pray to these apostles because they're right up there in the right hand and the left hand. We're not talking to people with special authority or to people who are particular close to Jesus, who have his ear. They're not somebody who can lobby for help and assistance. They offer us none. They were but the witnesses who saw the death and resurrection of Jesus and then declared it to the world. That was their job, that was their task, that was their appointed place in history, and that's what they did. This episode has wider implications than just the position of James and John and the apostles. This passage reveals for us the way of the world, the way of Christians, and the way of Christ. For Jesus comments on the way of the world, verse 42, you know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles are the non-Jewish nations, lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Totalitarian regimes still rule a large percentage of the world's population. And democratically elected governments are not beyond repressing people. Oscar Wilde tickled my fancy. Democracy means simply the bludgeoning of the people for the people by the people. Democracy is the power of the majority. It's not the rule of righteousness or justice. Remember, even Hitler and Mussolini won elections. I've lived through the times of totalitarian regimes, Joseph Stalin, Mao, Idi Amin, Pol Pot, Pinochet, the generals in Argentina, just to mention the ones fairly quickly and well known, monsters who reigned during my lifetime. The world has been and still is full of oppressive regimes. Take, for example, Turkmenistan, an area of people that have been oppressed by one foreign ruler after another. Alexander the Great conquered them, and then they've been conquered by the Persians, the Arabs, the Turks. Genghis Khan, of course, conquered them, and the Iranians did, the Afghanistanis did, and then finally the Russians. Then in 1991, with the collapse of the Soviet bloc, they gained their independence. And an ex-communist became the president, and then he became the president for life. I always have trouble now pronouncing Russian names, but the Turkmenistan name even more. Saparmurat Niyazov is my best guess. Those of you who knew him personally, I'd be interested to talk to you later. He died in December 21st last year, just a couple of months ago. It's hard to evaluate the man from Western media, but he appears to be an eccentric, authoritarian, repressive dictator. He set up statues and pictures of himself all over the land. One gold one he set up in the middle of the city, which actually rotates with the sun so as to reflect the glory on the streets around about. He renamed the months of the years and the days of the month of the week after different members of his family. He renamed cities, schools, and even a meteorite after himself. He removed the books from the schools and the libraries and replaced them with his own book that everybody had to read and study. He declared, and this is how I know about the man because it's just a fantastic idea, he declared National Melon Day. And he told people that they were to chew on bones in order to improve their teeth and save on dental bills. It's funny, but it's not funny, because this man brutally oppressed the nation for his own aggrandisement. You know that those who are regarded as rulers lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. All over the world, all down the centuries, Jesus' words ring true. It's why we need democracy, an organised civil way to remove rulers. That's what it is. But yet, around the world, the great advocate of democracy, the United States of America, is hated. Hated for its oppressive intervention into the affairs of other countries, hated in it for its militarism, hated for its financial control over the world, hated for its cultural imposition upon the world. And so far I've talked about governments and nations, and it's all true. But it's out there, isn't it? Most of us are not going to be in parliament and in government, and those of us who are, it's a long way off. But it's true of all positions of power, down through the politics of the office, to the politics of the college, the politics of the junior common room, the politics of the family, the politics of marriage, the politics of home. It's the truism of Lord Acton, the Cambridge historian: power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. It's not just government. It's business and universities, it's the office and the institutions. It's wherever there is power, wherever people are ruling over people, they will always be lording it over the others, exercising authority over others. Give a parking attendant a walkie-talkie and a dust coat, and within half an hour you'll see Adolf Hitler revived. But ruling over others is not to be the way of Christians. For Jesus said, not so, verse 43, not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. There is this profound reversal of roles and dignity and place that you will see in Jesus' kingdom. For greatness is seen in service, not in pomp and show or power and influence or money or strength or reputation or celebrity. Greatness is seen in humility, the humility of the slave who is always serving the other person. How could you run a country that way? How could you run a family that way? How could you run life that way? Once you understand the death of the Lord Jesus Christ, you'll say, how could we run it any other way? Of course, we Christians have not always followed this instruction. Sadly, the pomp and ceremony of much church liturgy, the extravagant clerical robes, the endless honorific titles that are given to ministers. You know, one night I went to bed and I was reverend, and at midnight that night, while I was dead asleep, I suddenly became the very reverend. I woke up the next morning and I was the very reverend. I don't know how it was done to me, but it just happened to me. Fascinating thing. I am now the very reverend. What utter stupidity. My name is Philip. It was given to me at my baptism because I'm a Christian. And that's my Christian name. But churches have our processions and our dignitaries, ornate buildings and furniture, the thrones for the bishops, the princes of the church, the rings for people to kiss. It all screams out that these people, this institution, this structure has not understood the Jesus they profess. For Jesus said explicitly, "It is not so amongst you." But why? Why is it not to be amongst them? Why is it not to be the way amongst Christians? Because, thirdly, it's not the way of Christ. 4 verse 45. Even the Son of Man, now you see I've set all the context to come to the verse we started with. Even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus, the Son of Man, as he called himself, more of that another night, Jesus didn't come into the world to be served. He could have. He made the world. He rules the world. It's his world. He could have come to be served, but he came to serve. And his service was not vague and general, but was very precise and particular. He came into the world to give his life as a ransom for many. For the Bible teaches that all humanity is in bondage. We've all been kidnapped by the evil one, and our hearts are now all corrupt, which was the point of last night's talk. There are CDs of each of these talks. You can pick one up if you weren't here last night. Sorry, you didn't make it. Pick one up on the way out. Glad for you to be having it. But it's that verse back in chapter 7, verse 21. For from within our hearts come evil thoughts, sexual immorality. All these, verse 23, all these evils come from inside. We are now in bondage. The good that I want to do, I don't do. The bad that I don't want to do, I do. Do you want to tell lies? Well, why do you? So, well, I don't have to if I don't want to. Okay, go a day without telling a lie. You won't get there. I used to have this man who always said to me he didn't believe that he was bad, that he could be as good as he wanted to be. And so he used to come to church for supper, just at the end, the coffee, the tea. Missed the sermons regularly, but he turned up for coffee and tea. And he used to always challenge me about it. So I said to him, look, this week, go for a whole week without telling a lie. He said, that'll be easy. So he came back the next week at coffee time, very shamefaced, and I said, well, how did it go? He said, it wasn't fair. I said, Ron, how's it not fair? And I said, it was very simple. You're going to go for a week without telling a lie because you're a good person. You don't have to tell lies. He said, well, you know, I've changed jobs. I said, yes, yes, you did mention you're getting a new job. And he said, well, that's why it wasn't fair. I said, well, why? He said, well, I've become a real estate agent. It's not fair. We need another test. We're in bondage, friends, to evil. It becomes natural for us to do the wrong things. And not only are we bondage to evil, but also in bondage to death. For death is the penalty of our rebellion against God. And death and the diseases that lead to death, for life here and now is disordered by the normality of death, is something that we really need to address. Tomorrow night I'm going to be talking about death in the profit motive in religion. Is your philosophy of life sorted out about your mortality, your death? See, the cross of Christ confronts us with death. And it's the only certain future any of us have got. You don't even know if you're going to pass your exam. Some of you know you're not. You don't know if you're going to pass it, but you do know you're going to die. So if your philosophy of life hasn't coped with your mortality, it's a dud. Come tomorrow night. But for now, the Bible teaches that we're all in bondage, into sin and to Satan, to decay and to death. But Jesus comes into the world in order to ransom by giving his life for us in our place. He dies as our ransom. We are the kidnapped. He takes our place in our captivity and dies to purchase our freedom. This is at the heart of the kingdom. It's giving self-sacrificially, serving and slaving for others. This is why the brother's request was so inappropriate. This is why it's inappropriate for Christians in Jesus' kingdom to rule over each other like the way the world rules over each other. And so Jesus asks the question, what do you want me to do for you? What do you want Jesus to do for you? What do I want him for me? If we had him tonight, what single thing would we ask him to do? You know, Harry, the stone was really not such a wonderful thing. As much money and life as you could want, two things that human beings would choose above all. The trouble is, humans have a knack for choosing precisely those things which are worst for them. What we need is forgiveness. What we need is change of heart. We need to be rescued from our inherited immorality. We need to be rescued from our inevitable mortality. We need to be given a new and a fresh start. If you're picking up a book in the bookstore, here's one called A Fresh Start. A Fresh Start. It's up that way. That's what we need. That's what we saw last night, and that's what we're going to see in the coming nights. When we look at death, when we look on Thursday night at morality's failure, when we look at what Jesus did to ransom us out of our immorality, out of our bondage, out of our death. The answer to our need is found in the meaning of Jesus' death, for by his death he paid our penalty and purchased our freedom, so that we no longer have to live on death's row. We can now leave prison and start living a new life. But of course it requires you to trust Jesus with our lives. Who better can I trust with my life than the Son of Man who died for me so that I can live? Abraham Lincoln said, "No man is good enough to govern another man without the other's consent." He's a wise man, Lincoln, in lots of ways. I wouldn't give consent easily to anybody, and I would certainly not want other people to have me as their ruler. You wouldn't do that unless you were sure that the other person had your best interests at heart, which of course is why we don't like politicians, because we're never persuaded that they have our best interests at heart. So I don't trust rulers and people in power, for I know that in the end, they'll all come to serve themselves, at my expense too. And I know that if I was elected to power, in due time, that's what I'd do too. Yet in Jesus, we have a king who rules not at my expense, but at his expense, dying for me that I don't have to die, who rules with my best interests at heart, not his own, dying for me to rescue me. He's the opposite of most rulers, for most rulers put us into armies and shove us out to die for them so that they can stay in power. He's the opposite of most rulers, because most rulers take my taxes so that they can live in comfort. But Jesus pays everything for me and lays down his life for me. He is a king who became the servant and slave. Now that's a ruler I can trust with my welfare, with my life, with my future. The one who died to ransom me.